Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we are going to continue with The Feminization of American Culture by Anne Douglas, published in 1977, a serious, intellectually rigorous feminist reviews American history, looking at how the Puritan fathers declined from serious students of theology into sort of menu-posting servants of American middle-class women. Sentiment replaced serious intellectual study. And we've also been talking in this chapter, chapter 5, which we're going to finish today, about how serious intellectual firepower was channeled from theology into history increasingly, but the masculine history of the people whose forerunners would have been the original Puritans were more interested in military history and sort of big picture history, leaving local antiquarian history to women and clergy. She always groups them together, sort of the way that Jews say always say women and minorities, to try to isolate white men. But they would deal with matters of local interest so that it wouldn't be forgotten and rescue it from oblivion, Douglas says was a typical phrase that was used. Anyway, picking it up on page 225 out of about 399, I think it is, for the endnotes, which are copious, the appendixes. Clerical and feminine biography from history to biology. And remember, she mentioned last time that women and clergy felt they were being overlooked, and their writing was an effort in part to assert their own independence, such as the Puritan mothers. I'm sick of hearing about the Puritan fathers. What about the Puritan mothers? What about the clergy in American history? It wasn't all military leaders and such. So, clerical and feminine biography from history to biology. The biographies women and ministers wrote in increasing numbers about themselves and each other over the middle decades of the 19th century mark the consolidation of the clerical feminine history, or flight from history. In 1839, Jared Sparks formulated a definition of the different types of biography current in his culture. The first kind is the, quote, historical biography, which admits of copious selections from letters and other original papers. The second is the memoir, whose method is more rambling and relating more to the affairs of a private nature. Almost all of Sparks's American biographies are entitled Lives and belong to the first category. The vast majority of the clerical and feminine biographies under consideration here are self-styled memoirs. So a more objective outside external view of someone's life versus their personal reflections. The antiquarians were attempting to create both a social and a re-Christianized history. They certainly avoided the arrogance inherent in the grand view of Hegelian intellectual history, and this is very much to their credit. The pacifist impulse I just described here is a profoundly sympathetic one, we heard about last time. From the antiquarian perspective, as from the traditional Protestant viewpoint, every life serves, with serves in italics. Whereas Hegel was saying, you know, no one could be, history is going to go where it will, and individual lives didn't matter at all. The number of books written on relatively obscure people, usually ministers or literary women, in the mid-19th century is enormous. Theoretically, they are valuable, just as unused television footage could be useful to our descendants. They offer a quotidian record, a record of the daily activity. Partial anticipators of the Braudelian and Ericksonian methods, the clerical and feminine biographers sought to convey what could be called the psychological topography of their era, how the average people were thinking. A more leftist history from the ground up, instead of the great men and the small women, the peasants rather than the nobles. Yet one cannot help feeling that this is neither their main purpose nor their principal achievement. To begin with, a number of these narratives managed to convey no genuine information at all. It seems a general rule in the development of social history that the excision of conceptualization can only go so far before significant detail, whose importance, ironically, is the raison d'etre, the reason for being of social history, and the titular reason for the exclusion of history also begins to disappear. Moreover, there is little development of any kind operating in the feminine clerical accounts. The primary impulse of the antiquarian is neither to confront man with God, as the Calvinist did, nor to explore the laws of man's internal growth as more recent, what we might term anti-patriarchal, psychologists and anthropologists have done. They wished, rather, to protect their subjects from competition, whether emanating from men, God, or the movement of time itself. Bancroft, Prescott, Motley, and Parkman, four of the seven major ones she named, major male historians, were always concerned with the individual, but they refused to sever him from the context of historical change, which both created and overcame his heroism. The antiquarians, like Sprague and his Annals, usually excluded the historical panorama. It could only serve to dwarf their less enterprising subjects. They bestowed a curious immunity from history on those they commemorated. I wish to be as precise as possible here. There is an enormous and vital distinction between an interested, respectful acceptance of the full human condition and a glorification of the death of the critical interest, or critical instinct, between acknowledging human limitations and celebrating them. This is not a difference merely between good and bad social history. The first is a religious impulse. The second is, finally, a commercial one, and eventually involves the preparation of the individual for the role of consumer. For the consumer is, by definition, the man with no interest in theorizing, the person possessed of only the haziest powers of discernment. There are notable exceptions, but as a genre, one must say, that the clerical feminine biographies represent the first, although hardly the last, use of the biographical form as calculatedly therapeutic indulgence in the experience of ordinary human personality. As such, they marked a significant break in the tradition of ministerial biography. In 1796, Samuel Hopkins wrote an account of one of his most devout parishioners, a fervidly prayerful woman called Susanna Anthony. So 1796, Samuel Hopkins writing about Susanna Anthony. He was hardly the first or last minister to memorialize feminine devotion to God and to himself. It was more striking, however, when almost a century later, women began to preserve clerical lives for posterity. We have already seen that Elizabeth Peabody published her Reminiscence of William Ellery Channing in 1880. Sylvester Judd's confidence in feminine ability to appreciate was not ill-placed. One of his best correspondents, his cousin, Arethusa Hall, gave his story to the world in a most sympathetic memoir published in 1853. Interchanged letters and intimate conversations were only a prelude to a more prominent exchange in which clerical and feminine sensibilities interacted for posterity. Women like Hall or Peabody were indeed caretakers they had been chosen to be. Popular sermonizers loved to dwell on the picture of the three Marys at Christ's tomb, and the deceased liberal minister usually had his feminine grave watchers and believers also. "Let the poor, the widows, and the orphan write the minister's epitaph," one clergyman exhorted in the New Englander in 1845, and sometimes they did. Beginning approximately in the 1840s, the authorship of clerical biography underwent a decided shift. The most prominent ministers of the 18th century, the 1700s, were usually memorialized by their brethren, their intellectual peers, whether contemporary or later. Hopkins wrote the life of Jonathan Edwards. Edwards A. Park did biographies of Hopkins and his ablest heir, Nathaniel Emmons. The 19th century clergyman, especially if he belonged to a liberal group, was apt to have a feminine biographer. Not only Channing and Judd, but Horace Bushnell, Orville Dewey, Austin Phelps, Charles Follen, Joseph Buckminster, and Frederick Dan Huntington come to mind as genuinely prominent clerical figures whose lives were written by feminine friends and relatives. Of my sample group of 30 ministers, 21 had at least one full-scale biography written about them in the generation after their death. 50% of these were by women. Not surprisingly, the biographies of ministers from feminine hands were somewhat different in nature from their predecessors. In a novel appropriately entitled Papa's Own Girl, 1874, Marie Howland, a feminist writer and utopian thinker, summed up the credo of the new feminine biographers with more frankness than most of them would have relished. There's a block quote from her. Women are beginning to see the folly of allowing their lords, quote-unquote, to write the biographies of great men, and are gradually taking the task upon themselves. When they do their full share of this work, there will be found in history many pygmies that would have swelled to colossi under the pens of their own sex. For their claims to honor the greatness of as moral forces will be judged by the way they treat women, especially and generally. A man may be great in a particular sense, if he is nothing but a military or political leader, but he can never be great integrity as a man if he lacks tenderness, justice, or faith in humanity. Men who are very tender as lovers, and deeply sensitive to the influence of women, usually have the reputation among brutal men of being, quote, henpecked, unquote, a word never found in the vocabulary of refined people. Refined people never use the word henpecked. Keep that in mind. That's the report from a feminist in 1840s. You can see the basic larval SJW, can't you? Social justice warrior. That's not funny. Domestic setting and domestic motivation dominate the memoirs written by the daughters, wives, and friends of Unitarian and Congregational clergymen. These men are presented, naturally, as they are viewed from a feminine perspective. They appear primarily as fathers and husbands. Elizabeth Stuart Phelps emphasized her father's emotional and more particularly his family life. Orville Dewey's daughter quotes much more extensively from his family letters than from his theological works. Charles Follen's wife Eliza, in an exceptionally fine memoir, pays ample tribute to her husband's pioneering efforts in education and theology, but she stresses above all else his kindness and consideration to family and friends. Earlier ministers and their biographers had not emphasized their domestic needs as predominant. Thomas Shepard's moving account, penned in 17th century Massachusetts, of the loss of his wife through childbed fever, was intended to instruct the reader on the fallibility of earthly relations, not to display his own capacities for familial feeling. By the turn of the 18th century, however, a split was noted, or created, between ministers' public and private selves by their biographers. Jonathan Edwards, Jr., for example, who could be, quote, irresistibly impressive and even terrible in the pulpit, was, quote, mild and affectionate, unquote, at home. Stephen West in church seemed a herald sent down to denounce God's wrath upon a guilty world. In his family, his manners were as, quote, bland as those of a refined and lovely woman. Interesting. There is a hint here that the true self is the private, non-professional one, that West was, as Catherine Maria Sedgwick liked to imply, somehow unable to display his winning pastoral qualities once on his feet delivering a sermon. Later ministers, according to their own testimony, as well as that of their biographers, drew professional inspiration from their domestic affections, which they counted all important. Women were allowed, indeed encouraged, to confess that to love and be loved was their most important mission in life, even the start of their religious faith. Bushnell apparently felt equally eager to admit that, quote, it is the strongest want of my being, to love, unquote, and his daughter was ready to domesticate his statement further. Quote, it was in family life that he shone brightest. Sylvester Judd testified to the same hearthside creed. Though I am a minister, I can never forget that I am a man, a lover, a husband. The sentimental part of my nature is deep, strong, pervasive. I am Stroft. It is to me almost religion. Again, you see the decline into utter feeling. Ministers were granted, and they courted, other traits which they elsewhere recognized as peculiarly feminine and domestic. Nothing reveals the parasitic relationship between women and ministers better than their mutual habit of commemorating their commemorators, and in strikingly similar terms. I wrote in an earlier chapter about the modesty, the ostensible lack of ambition, clergymen and ladies increasingly claim for themselves and those they admired. Eliza Follen, Elizabeth Phelps, and Mary Bushnell Cheney all stressed the humility, the self-effacement of the men whose biographies they were writing. Bushnell himself, we remember, began his autobiography with the modest if inaccurate statement, quote, "My figure in this world has not been great. I have almost never been a president or vice president of any society. Take the report of my doings on the platform of all the world's business, and it is naught. I have filled no place at all. But, in my separate and merely personal," she puts in italics, "merely personal life, I have had a greater epic transacted than was ever written or could be." Bushnell is here paying himself not simply the same compliment his daughter gives him, but the favorite tribute clerical biographers offered their feminine subjects. Reverend Daniel D. Addison, a liberal clergyman, opened his memoir of Lucy Larcom with the standard obeisance to her apparent insignificance. Quote, "Her life was one of thought, not of action. In their outward movement, her days flowed on very smoothly. She had no remarkable adventures, but she had a constant succession of mental vicissitudes," those are changes, ups and downs, "which are often more dramatic and real than the outward events of even a varied life." Henry Bacon's biography of Charlotte follows a similar pattern. Bacon, a Universalist pastor and editor-in-chief of the Universalist and Ladies' Repository magazine, first recognized Charlotte's fictional and poetic gifts while she was working at 15 at a bindery in Boston. A working-class girl of undoubted force and talent, Charlotte Phila Brown died in 1845 at age 25. Bacon begins, block quote, "Our record here is of a pure-hearted and heroic woman, not heroic because of any wonderful exhibition of female intrepidity, but because of a sustaining and persistent energy that made the best of life as it came, not refusing to do little in the way of culture because a great deal could not be done. The truest heroism is that which seldom finds a place in history, and to proclaim which the trumpet of fame is too brazen." It's those little people who work behind the scenes, patiently, without demanding any respect or admiration. "She had no very striking qualities to command the attention of the world," unquote. She, quote, "lived to love." This tribute, like Bushnell's evaluation of his place in the world, does not represent quite the Christian humility of Jonathan Edwards, who could account himself a worm and wish to lie infinitely low before God. It suggests rather the complex art of apology in which abasement and exaltation intertwine. The self is not being humiliated, as it is in Edwards' journals. The public itself, in the case of Bushnell, Larcom, and Giraud, a very interesting one, is effaced in order to bring forth a private self for attention, celebration, and caressing. It is the overemphasis, not the emphasis on the personal, which is distressing. The fascination of the ministerial and feminine biographies lies precisely in their intensely and consciously privatized mood. One might argue that their insistence on the obscurity of their subjects is a necessary part of their calculated secretiveness. Only in learning about those who theoretically have no reason to believe their private lives will be a public concern can the reader respond most fully as a voyeur. Only if the subject is someone ostensibly no better than herself can the reader's voyeurism function as an introduction to her own sensibility and as a narcissistic enmeshment of herself, or in herself. The aim of these memoirs is to establish an atmosphere of intimacy so strong as to replace historical awareness with what seems almost biological consciousness. The biographer's obsessive stress on his subject's capacities for suffering and for sympathy with the world of process, draws the reader into the innermost sanctums of personality. Bushnell's life, as his daughter described it, and as he probably actually lived it, was a Christian struggle with pain. He fought consumption for years before the end. Lying awake during sleepless nights coughing, he would rise the next day and work at a book or some task, almost dying in a mountain climbing expedition. He barely recovered, not to go home, but to get up and reach the summit. Existing finally with one lung, he began a theological treatise on inspiration. Only months before his death, just to draw, as he wrote, a little sense of being from it. His own bodily weaknesses made him preoccupied with, quote, forgiveness, which he described as, quote, man's deepest need and highest achievement. Austin Phelps, according to his daughter, endured a lonely and miserable childhood, As an adult, he patiently suffered tortures from the neuralgia and insomnia, which many of his colleagues and critics blamed on a weak will rather than a flawed constitution. He felt forced to a great sacrifice, as he described it, in abandoning pastoral work early in his career while tending two wives and fatal illnesses. He became a compassionate and loving nurse. Naturally, Phelps brooded increasingly on the meaning of the act of intercession, on the special abilities granted to the disabled. Charles Follen, as his wife memorialized him, to fulfill a duty to the world which she found a crucifixion for herself, was a timid and frail child, never sympathetic with boys. Later in America, he spent himself for Harvard students only to be defrauded and turned away by the university authorities. He prepared brilliant lectures and delivered them conscientiously and enthusiastically to an audience of two or three persons. He labored for an often indifferent congregation whose final unreasonable demands resulted in his untimely death in a shipwreck. Follen learned the lessons of, quote, disinterestedness, unquote, the value of devotional feelings and tenderness. Follen's role, like Bushnell's or Phelps's, is the immolated one assigned the pious woman in contemporary fiction and biography. Mary Clemmer Ames, a noted journalist and writer, published a memoir of her friend, the genuinely talented, if minor, poet Alice Carey, 1820-71, in 1874. As for Eliza Follen, the very task of writing was painful for Ames. "Every line coming from memory has deepened the wound of irreparable loss," she begins, describing Carey's deprived childhood, her early disappointment in love, her rich but secluded life filled with illness, self-doubt, and unappreciated aspirations, or unachieved aspirations, her intense but mournful love of her own sex, and her indignation at their wrongs. Ames reveals, as she intended, what Carey as a woman could be and was to another. Although Carey courted death by prolonged periods of toil in overheated rooms, when it came in 1871, she fought it. Carey longed perhaps for a fuller life than she had ever had, for a fuller release of her unmistakable though stunted creativity. But Ames makes of her final fierce reluctance a kind of feminine Gethsemane. She stresses that, dying in summer in a hot city, Carey missed the countryside where she had been born and bred. In her last hours, Carey was happy, according to Ames, only when hearing those portions of the gospel which recount Christ's love of women. Henry Bacon, in his memoir of Charlotte, takes a similar line. 5 years have passed, he begins, and on the anniversary of Charlotte's death, we begin this memorial. The heavy rains are falling, and the sultry air of this August day is oppressive, but the sunlight penetrates the clouds. Bacon sounds as if Charlotte has become a saint. God marks her day with special signs. In telling of Charlotte's death, Bacon, like Ames, stresses her, quote, longing to get into the country, to smell the green trees and the fresh air, her sorrow, and her extreme and significant attachment to a passage in a sermon by F.W.P. Greenwood called Christ, Our Fellow Sufferer. With no justification but the logic of the martyrdom he is bestowing on Charlotte, Bacon hypothesizes her special fondness for passages like this, quote, loving him, and comforted by his sympathy when I weep in fear, I am better prepared to follow and imitate him when he submits, endures, and triumphs. Like Christ, Charlotte did not wrestle with her Maker as though she was wronged by suffering. She consented to her pain. These accounts vary greatly in style and value. The Bushnell and Follen biographies are broad and still indispensable studies. The Charlotte biography does no justice even to its rather slight subject. Yet all these narratives imply that their protagonists are performing a ritual of Bushnellian atonement, and that this ritual assimilates them to a natural world whose law of development and decay usurps the prerogatives of time. The preoccupation with suffering in all six memoirs, the references to the country and the weather in the narratives about Charlotte and Carey, the intrusion of the pain experienced by the authors in the Follen and Carey and Charlotte books, highlight a tendency common to ministerial-feminine biographies of the period, although hardly equally present in all of them, an avoidance of the prominent use of dates, and a replacement of these by what could be called the organic markers, birth, conversion, marriage, aging, and above all, illness and death. These markers are the lowest common denominator of human life. In the weaker of these volumes, the average life cycle is treated here as of greater historical importance than any extraordinary achievement. The phenomena of biology are applauded as comprising the history of the average. Historicity is dissolved in atmosphere. A potentially cyclical pattern dislodges a linear one. Masculine attempts at domination and demarcation give way to feminine abilities for assimilation and absorption. The active force of public example is lost in the persuasive rights of protection and dependency established by the nurturing power of memory. Biography is merged with something close to a vegetation myth. The clergyman himself, as he is described in the reminiscences penned by literary women and liberal ministers, increasingly resembled a benign and patriarchal god at home and at one with a natural setting. Nowhere in this transformation clearer than in the treatment of the very old minister, the survivor from the grimmer days of Calvinist theology, by his younger successors and his feminine admirers. A test case for the new sensibility, the patriarch, as he was called in spirit almost antithetical to the one in which we use the word today, was softened and subsumed into the organic right of life, rights of life. Edwards A. Park, in his memoirs of Emmons and Hopkins, continuously makes both sound like very aged men. In a sense, this is understandable. Hopkins and Emmons lived to extremely advanced ages. Both were in youth, as in maturity, sober and serious individuals. Park drew many of his impressions of Emmons from his meetings with him at the end of his very long life. There can be little doubt, however, that Park wants to picture his predecessors primarily in old age. That age is, in his memoirs, part of their very essence, rather than a temporal condition. They were born old. The figures are fragile, as in Park's delineation, as old manuscripts. In his biography of Emmons, Park includes a vignette, relayed by another minister, of the later Emmons preaching to his elderly congregation. His theme was, quote, "Men are more merciful to their enemies than God is to his." Imagine that in one of those signs out front of the churches today. It'd be funny. They're afraid to come hard. They're afraid to break bad and tell you the truth about God and that you're going to hell. They just won't. They will not tell people what they need to hear. They will only tell people what they want to hear. Anyway, this is the vignette. Quote, "I saw one old man after another who had grown gray under the patriarch's ministrations, bending forward in breathless silence, rising at length from their seats, and gazing with eagerness to catch every word that fell from the lips of their teacher, an old man who held his manuscript before his face and read it in a low monotone." That is, he's not putting any performance values in. It's purely the quality of the sermon and the importance of its message that is drawing the raptness of the audience. This is a ministerial dream, a like-minded, masculine, congregation compelled by the sheer force of truth as presented by God's clerical envoy. Yet the point here is that the aged are addressing the aged. They are striking mementos of past virtue, but they are also fossilized, weakened, and sentimentalized. The emotions they arouse in us are more important than the emotions they feel. They have been deflected precisely through their gray hairs and silvered piety from subjects to objects. Hosea Ballou, the most important figure in early American Universalism, also suffered a mysterious change of character in the hands of his memoirists. Ballou, despite his conviction that, quote, "holiness and true happiness are inseparably connected," his love of nature, his sometimes maudlin hymns, his distrust of learning, and his faith in an essentially untrained ministry, was no sentimentalist. He found the ministry a, quote, "spiritual warfare," unquote, and conducted himself accordingly. attacking Calvinists, Unitarians, and, when provoked, fellow Universalists, with vigor and acumen. Like Hopkins and Emmons, he lived to a ripe old age, and long before his death, he was being hailed as a patriarch. He wore his white hair long and, according to his son, had a, quote, remarkably vengeful appearance. His face was a benediction. His feelings were tender. Caroline M. Sawyer, the wife of a Universalist pastor, and herself a leading figure in the little literary coterie which put out the genteel publication of her denomination, The Ladies' Repository and The Rose of Sharon, wrote a poem after hearing Ballou pray in 1843, a decade before his death at the age of 81. She entitled it, The Pleader at the Throne. Colon. Ballou is a mediator, not a commander. On another occasion, Mrs. Sawyer described in prose Ballou's memorable effect on his audience. Block quote here. She says, No one who is present then and there can ever forget the impression made by the saintly white-haired old man as he arose in the pulpit, looked slowly around upon the vast congregation. Most of them saw him for the first and last time there, and then meekly but fervently breathed out the tenderest prayer that ever reached the ear of the good father. There is something very unsubstantial about the figure of Ballou here. He breathes rather than speaks. He is seen for the first and last time, vanishing into the realm of memory, which is his only kingdom. At Ballou's funeral in 1852, his colleague and successor, Reverend Alonzo A. Minor, also a contributor to the Ladies' Repository and the Rose of Sharon, extolled him again and again as, quote, our venerable patriarch, our venerable father, our father in Israel. According to Minor, Ballou's great contribution to liberal theology had been his stress on the, quote, paternal spirit, unquote, of God. He, quote, effected a very general redemption from that state of orphanage to which so large a part of the world felt itself doomed. There is little in Minor's eulogy to remind hearers that Ballou was ever young, that despite his humane and generous spirit, he was almost always aggressive. Ballou has been canonized in old age, frozen in a benediction. He dwindles in the reader's imagination even as he accrues significance. Sawyer and Minor look on him like departing travelers gazing back on a figure which gets smaller and smaller, and then is lost to view. Ballou, like Hopkins and Emmons, is becoming a relic, precious, talismanic, culturally crucial, but obsolete. Let me say a little more about the connotations around the patriarch figure in the contemporary subculture which was claiming these ministerial figures for its patron saints. The patriarch appears again and again in the sentimental literature of the antebellum period. He is always, in every respect, the opposite of the so-called Victorian father. Lydia Huntley Sigourney did the classic sentimental studies of false and true male dominance, one entitled The Father, the other The Patriarch, both published in The Young Lady's Offering in 1847. Symbolically, The Father opens the 1862 collection of tales, but The Patriarch closes it. The last word is his. The father is a brilliant, cultured, and driving businessman, Byronic in character, tempestuous and excitable in disposition, rigid and proud in will. He spends his life in increasing his fortune and educating his delicate, chaste, and adored daughter, occasionally laying the classic female hand on his classically fevered male brow. She provides a needed antidote to his unspecified but highly successful activities in the world. Ostensibly, he is the commanding one in the relationship. He stays up whole nights planning her reading. He gloats over her like Pygmalion over Galatea. Was it strange that I should gaze on the work of my own hands with ineffable delight? He inquires. It is the male committing the ultimate heresy. He imagines he can create life. Sigourney has chastisement waiting, however, in the wings. The daughter dies unexpectedly. The father goes through an agony of grief until, positively rigid with hysteria, unable to sleep or to weep, he throws himself on her grave and even tries, apparently, to exhume her. Finally, on her burial mound, he cries, and Sigourney can forgive him, for he weeps that he has lost a woman, that he is not a woman able to create life, and in weeping, he is like a woman. Curiously, Sigourney has made no mention of the mother in her tale. Her place is empty waiting to receive the Father when he resigns his rule. Sigourney's patriarch is a dummy figure set up for compensating worship in place of the deposed father. He is the ancestor comfortably stowed away in the rocking chair, the male softened by the kindly touch of time. His reign is a tribute to the sensitivity and receptivity of his subjects, not to his own powers of direct exertion. He rules by his example and by their regard for tradition, possessing no force but influence. He is essentially connotative. The small, self-sufficient rural community which he heads is what Sigourney calls hermetically sealed. The spot is swamp-encircled. Iconographically, it suggests very feminine territory, like a womb. Cut off from civilization, its occupants do nothing but hold primitively simple and pious outdoor religious services and venerate their elders. At school, they learn only the three R's and the Bible. There is no story here. In this timeless and totally self-involved world, there can be no dialectic, no progress of any kind, nothing but ceremonious repetition. Progress smacks of excitement, of masculinity. A feminine ripeness is all Sigourney or the patriarch desires. Appropriately, the narrator-observer is a minister who helps establish a chapel for the little society and attends the patriarch's funeral at the sketch's close. Of course, Mrs. Sigourney is not here writing history or biography, yet I might point out that it is almost impossible to separate her historical from her fictional work. It is not unfair to see Mrs. Sigourney's father and patriarch as roughly analogous to the subjects of romantic biography and the ministerial feminine memoir. Sigourney's father, like the Pilgrim Fathers, the Founding Fathers, are the heroes of Hegelian history, stands for energy, enterprise, virility, direction, hubris. His sin is to try to change nature. Taught with unreleased grief, tearing futilely at the closed earth, the father, as Sigourney describes him, is sterile until he acknowledges the limits of his authority. Sigourney's patriarch, in contrast, suggests the aged minister of the memoir. He is less the impregnator than the pregnant. He suggests the precondition for futility. Absolutely not a leader, he belongs to his community only because he embodies its shared and common feelings and aspirations. Fit representative of clerical and feminine hopes and anxieties, he is the ultimate, almost parodic emblem of influence, of totally consensus and conformist thought. The only authority he seeks and possesses is, figuratively speaking, biological. His corpse goes into the earth, from which the community's sustenance will come. We are back with Bushnell's rationale for the history of oblivion. Do the vegetable growths repine or sicken because they cannot remember the growths of the previous centuries? Is it not enough that the very soil that feeds them is fertilized by the waste of so many generations moldering in it? Bushnell's Hegelian interest in organic imagery does not conceal his un-Hegelian philosophic emphasis. The waste so essential to Hegelian notions of a historicity has not simply been redeemed. Waste, as the reject of time and change, has been elevated in importance above the forces which define and throw it off. The intimate atmosphere of the memoirs is attended upon the private act of hoarding, which is their essential dynamic. The genuine lessons of compassion the antiquarians would teach cannot obfuscate the enormously tenacious importance they placed on personal possession, broadly defined. On Worcester's battlefields, in Elizabeth Phelps's Heaven, in the memoirs devoted to Austin Phelps, Alice Carey, and others, nothing can happen because there are no events, only objects and emotions, which are increasingly merged together on display. There can be violation or preservation of order, but not genuine change. In their well-founded fear of historicity, the feminine clerical historians substituted space for time as the fundamental dimension of human experience. As is the case with modern telecasters, they paid attention to groupings rather than progressions. They were interested in the relationship of the individual with what he or she owns, with what in an almost biological sense belongs to him and her, whether family, home, job, or even the sense of self. In their vision, the forging, severing, and recreating of such attachments substituted for the dialectic of the Hegelians. And with that, we end chapter 5. Sort of, she's constantly counterposing the Hegelian dynamic, active, masculine impregnator, changer of the world for the homebody, the feelings and possessions, the place where nothing ever changes. Anyway, this is kind of the changing attitudes and some of the changing feelings about the world and changing literary tastes, changing ministers, the profession of the minister, the type that went into the ministry, the sort of subjects it covered, or the way it's covered those subjects changed is what we've been seeing. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.